Hello and welcome to The Insiders, offering insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we continue our conversation with General Romeo Dallaire about the forces of genocide and what it might take to prevent future genocides. Then, a new film explores the unique challenges of women, soldiers, and veterans. Then, on the Scholar's Circle, on the two-year anniversary of Citizens United decision, we explore the decision's effects, the deeper issues, and the possible solutions. Last week, we began our conversation with General Romeo Dallaire, who was commander of the United Nations peacekeeping forces in Rwanda just before the genocide occurred. He had warned his superiors of the likelihood of bloodshed and asked for both permission to act and for support. Both were denied, and 800,000 people were brutally killed. The institutional failure was one of three failures that he noted. Since then, General Dallaire has spent his life focused on how to prevent such atrocities. He has written two books, Shake Hands with the Devil and They Live Like Soldiers, They Die Like Children, about child soldiering. He is also the co-director of the Will to Intervene Project. Welcome, General Dallaire. If we were going to now fast forward to today and we see the uprisings going on in the Middle East, for example, are there lessons we can draw from there to then look at another set of arbitrarily created states? Mm-hmm. What do you think we can draw from your experience?
One of the fundamental changes is the fact that we're living a revolutionary era in technology. That is to say, the availability of communications down to the individual and the ability of an individual to be able to muster and sort of coalesce a lot of other individuals and sustain it through continuous communications and so build forces, build movements, build activists and so on. That did not exist then. It exists now. And it's not done in isolation because these systems are now possible to monitor from outside. And so you're getting direct inputs on a daily basis of what's happening. So nothing is done in delayed motion. Things are done in your face now all the time. That is a major factor that's different from the past. So people cannot build up things in isolation. If there's going to be a revolution, if it's going to be an uprising, so on, you can see it moving, you can inject into it right away, and you can respond to it right away because you've got it right away. Now, what did happen, however, is in the interim period, a lot of people wrote a lot of stuff. A lot of people talked a lot, and a lot of people sort of negotiated and looked at the problem of what had happened in Rwanda. We had had Cambodia before that, and we had Srebrenica going on also, and they started saying, there's got to be a way around this. So by 1999, the UN realizes that it needed some significant reforms, and it brought in the Brahimi Report that was major reforms in how to do peace. It was a lot of tactical stuff, but very useful stuff. But the fundamental reforms were in the hand of Kofi Annan as Secretary General and was mandated by the United States, who backed him up, to bring in these reforms because the UN is ineffective. He then introduced in 2003 a significant report that had about 101 recommendations of enormous ramifications, including the makeup of the permanent members of the Security Council. And they discussed it, negotiated. And 3 months before the 2005 General Assembly, where they were going to approve these reforms to start implementing them, your ambassador, Bolton, essentially scrapped the whole damn thing. So the reforms are there to be picked up and to be applied. Nobody has really picked them up, except for one. And that was the one called Responsibility to Protect. And what that did is by 2001, a group of middle powers and so on got together and produced a doctrine that essentially—
When you say middle powers, you mean within the UN?
Well, all the countries. But middle powers, not necessarily using UN resources, but national resources and coalescing, led by Canada.
Who were the others?
Australia. Okay. There were some African countries, South Africa, Asian countries, and Germany was involved, the Dutch, the Swedes. They got together and produced a doctrine that essentially said that sovereignty is no more an absolute, because this is what these guys were hiding behind. So they said, if a leadership of a nation is massively abusing the human rights of its people or can't stop it, then the rest of the world has a responsibility through the UN to go in and protect the innocent people. And it was sold in 2005 to the world. Now, it scared a whole bunch of people. Although they agreed to it, the small countries said, hey, wait a minute, particularly those run by dictators, they said, what happens if the big boys want to use that to come in and take us on? So they
started, which is a possibility.
Yes, absolutely, and wouldn't have been the first time. So there's a concern about that. But what really caught us off guard was the big powers are saying, you know, this could drag us into stuff that we don't want to do. The United States didn't want to get into Rwanda. Nobody else was interested in Rwanda. There was nothing there. Why do we want to get in the middle of such a terrible mess? And God knows what casualties we'll have, particularly after Mogadishu. And so let's see these
things
play out.
And it may also pit people within an organization like the United Nations against powers like the United States in situations like Israel-Palestine.
Well, you've got, in fact, a world body that is trying to maneuver with big powers having established their positions, beforehand, and not necessarily wanting to use the UN as the instrument to resolve it. They sort of wanted to do more bilateral stuff or multilateral stuff outside of the UN. So we have the proof with Libya that our responsibility to protect is there, although it's not necessarily being used as the term, but they did use it. I mean, they isolated politically Gaddafi, they isolated the country economically, and then they went in and used force to try to stop the killing. It is a first use of responsibility with the UN mandate to go into a country, a sovereign state, and try to sort the situation out. And so there's lots of learning to be done in regards of failing states and trying to reestablish nascent democracies with rule of law, good governance, human rights, gender equality, and so on. I think now the head of the iceberg of revolutions in failing states and weak nations is now obvious, and it's a matter of us trying to sort out how we want to intervene, not only militarily, but politically, economically, to hopefully one day prevent these things going catastrophic, let alone trying to stop them.
As I understood, the killing in Rwanda were mainly civilians.
It's very true and reflective of civil wars, where although you might have two warring factions, as we did in this case, we had the government forces of about 35,000. You had the rebel forces of about 12,000-13,000. Got a not classic war, but war between fighting forces. But behind the lines is where the slaughtering and the killing went on. And it's not unlike what happened in World War II, particularly in Eastern Europe, where although the troops were fighting the Russians, behind them, the Nazis and the Gestapo were wiping out hordes and hordes of people. You had then the extremists who were not in the military as such, although there were military leaders in that, who were exacting the slaughtering behind the lines. And that's why when I presented my plan to the UN, I said, I don't care about the two warring factions. They can go and beat up on each other as much as they want. What I need is troops to stop the slaughtering behind the lines. That's where we could attenuate the need for the war. If we stopped the slaughter, then there wouldn't be a need for those two to keep fighting because the reason of the fight was based on the fact that there was so much of the slaughtering going on. And when looking at that and assessing that, it became obvious that it wasn't all the soldiers up front that were doing the slaughtering, but the slaughtering was done by civilians. And the civilians were divided into the adults and youths. So although there was adult leadership, the bulk of the killing were done by the militia, the Interahamwe. And the Interahamwe was the youth wing of the political extreme party that had been converted into a militia. And so we're talking about 16 and 17-year-olds and 18 and 19-year-olds doing the bulk of the killing. It's these kids who had been indoctrinated and drugged up and, boozed up and so on, and also fear, going around and just slaughtering left, right, and center. So many of the checkpoints were manned by kids, either armed with the machetes or armed with the AK-47s, and they were responsible for a lot of the killing under adult supervision.
One of the issues with children is that their ethical development hasn't really solidified yet.
No, and that's why Canada and the United States led the charge in the year 2000 to establish the Optional Protocol on Child Rights that essentially says that anybody under the age of 18 is not to be armed, trained, or used in conflict because they are not considered to have the mature references in order to be able to take those decisions as adults. Now, people have argued that in certain societies, at 15, they're considered adults. Because by age, they're considered adults, and because the cultural milieu has given them responsibilities much younger than in other societies, doesn't mean that psychologically they're more prepared than the others. It just means that the community, the culture, has thrust that on them at an earlier age. That optional protocol, which was established, creates the criteria by which, if under the age of 18 are used, they're not to be held criminally responsible. They are, on the contrary, to be demobilized, rehabilitated, reintegrated, and, where required, put through a judicial system that is non-punitive. That's the baseline, and that's the reference of us going after anybody who's using children and arming them as primary weapons in wars around the world, to the tune of 250 to 300,000 at any one time.
There is a growth in extremism in the Western world, in Europe and the United States. And the United States has big growth in militia movements. What does it take to convince, and the word you use, indoctrinate, people to hate another group, like you saw in Rwanda? Is there something that you can draw from there to apply to the Western world, or is it not applicable?
It is the easiest route possible. It is a lot more difficult to accept the frictions of our differences and work within them than to simply use the frictions of our differences as tools of intolerance. We have in our developed world, and in Canada, the United States, very similar in our values and our sort of ethical references, our moral sort of standards, is that we have moved from, remember, in the 60s, this was massive abuses of human rights in those days in a country that is to lead the world in advancing human rights and democracy and freedom for all. We're not that far away from that experience, and we're into an era now where, because people can communicate so easily and people have more generally money and means, we tried to use that by moving a concept called tolerance. And so reconciliation and tolerance, and, you know, we tolerate each other. But that has fundamentally backfired, because when you establish an atmosphere of tolerance, it means that somebody is tolerating somebody else. That means that there's something there that's still in their gut that makes them still not comfortable. However, if we had moved to a higher plane, that is to say, if we had said, we are to respect each other because we are equal.
And embrace the differences.
You work within them. Yeah. It's not easy, but you work with it. Just look at, what if your daughter, your Caucasian family, and brings home a black or Hispanic person. How easy is that accepted? Now, still today, in our communities.
More and more, but yes.
Still. Yeah. So that reconciliation process is ongoing and is difficult and needs all the tools that we can bring to bear, the communications tools, the instruments, social structures, and so on, to attenuate the frictions and have people respect each other. Now, because that concept is not prevalent, I mean, we're working on it, and so on, and the concept of tolerance is still there, there are those who simply say, I don't tolerate this. And that is still an easy argument to use, which then permits, because of money, because of resources available, people can then coalesce in a negative sense. And so you get these militias and these extremist groups. How do you handle that? Two ways. One, you must be ruthless but fair. You weed them out. You literally take on these organizations that are fundamentally against the fundamental laws of the nation. There is no call for militia vigilante entities outside of the legal processes and institutions to defend the nation. There's no room for that. It's not acceptable. And so you take them on that way. Secondly, you work through education.
Can media be used
positively?
It's part of the education.
Well, its role is to be objective. And if it is objective, if it is transparent, it will provide you with the information you need to take objective decisions. But look at your media in this country.
Absolutely.
And tell me that all the media are working on a premise of objectivity.
Or any of them anymore in the broadcast world.
Well, I mean, you've got on one side, you've got the Lehrer Report on PBS, which has its sort of rent. And on the other side, you've got what? Fox. And I was interviewed in New York by a group. They were doing a special on Kofi Annan. And all the questions were skewed. They were not questions based on an objective point of view that you wanted to objectively present. They were skewed. They were sort of nuanced. And so your answers continuously either were defensive of whatever you were trying to defend, or you found yourself responding to absolutely fringe arguments without getting into the content. So at the end of it, and I was quite peeved, I asked this journalist, I said, what were you trying to do with this? I said, were you trying to get a story on Kofi Annan, or were you trying to crucify Kofi Annan? And blatantly, I was told, we're trying to crucify him. And she was from Fox.
Yeah.
So if the general population just takes one point of view, then we are in serious problems. However, if you've got a spectrum of points of view, because objectivity is so difficult to sustain in a business world and competitive world, then what you hope is your population is going to look at the spectrum. And so they're going to read or listen to from National Public Radio on one side all the way to Fox, and they'll make up their mind from that. And hopefully they don't focus on the one that makes them feel good and feeds them their perspective versus giving them an opportunity to take objective decisions. So we may be sophisticated societies, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we're mature.
Or it doesn't mean that we're not necessarily emotional.
Emotional can provide positive.
It can.
Yeah. But excess nationalism is a perfect source of division and can curtail good arguments coming to the fore. Excess nationalism prevented a lot of arguments on Iraq, a lot of arguments on Afghanistan, and so on. And in so doing, curtailed the objectivity that, in fact, you expect from a sophisticated society like the United States. And all the more so when the United States is the world leader. I mean, if you were the 163rd out of 193 countries, people would say, well, so what? But if you're number two or one in the world, there's a requirement that your citizenry achieve a level of sophistication and maturity to be able to master that incredible power and that innate responsibility beyond your borders.
Thank you so much, Senator Dallaire.
Yeah.
General Dallaire.
Yeah.
It's great to have you with us.
Thank you.
We're all in this together, trying to help each other find the answers. What went wrong? And why aren't they dealing with it? The war for us has been more of a war after we came home.
Since I've came back home, I've had all types of sickness. The sickness started in Saudi Arabia. I bleed from my rectum and they don't know why. I have no control of my bladder anymore. For 5 years I had stomach pains and they said that it was all in my head. The VA hospital said it was all in my head. And our symptoms are not getting better, they're getting worse. Somebody has to do something for us. I got up and readily went to serve my country. And I was so proud to be in the military. I always tell everybody, if they call me back tomorrow, I would go. Because I loved being in the military. But I hate being a veteran.
That was from the documentary Women at War. You are listening to The Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues, and I'm Maria Armudian. When surviving soldiers return from the battlefield, they face a second kind of war. Physically and mentally injured, they struggle to adjust back to society. Many end up homeless, accounting for a third of the homeless population, high suicide rates, and ongoing health impairments. In fact, more than 250,000 Gulf War veterans suffer from Gulf War syndrome, ostensibly from exposure to toxic chemicals chemicals and nerve gas antidotes. Among Gulf War syndrome victims are women who suffer respiratory, gynecological, and neurological disorders. Women veterans have ostensibly suffered the most. Some 41% of female vets report being sexually assaulted, and their health services are often considerably less. We have with us Christy and Dennis Davis, who have just finished the film Women at War that explores this particular issue. Welcome. You followed certain soldiers through their issues with the Gulf War and then after. Tell us one of the compelling stories.
The film is called Women at War, Forgotten Veterans of Desert Storm. And we're following women from 1991's Gulf War. We started the film in 2002, and it was before the war in Iraq, before the war in Afghanistan. So this was the first war that women were under combat conditions. As we've made the film during 2000 to 2011, we would read the accounts of women in the current war in Iraq, which just finished, and Afghanistan, and we found that so many of the same problems, unfortunately, were the problems that the veterans faced the first Gulf War, except for Gulf War illness. And when they came home, they had problems with homelessness, suicide. There are also problems with the Veterans Administration trying to get medical attention from the Veterans Administration. One of the stories that struck in my mind was one of the women during the first Gulf War talks about sexual assault that occurred during the war. She tells the story of being assaulted by a bus driver. And then when she goes back to her commanding officer and tells him about it, he says, "Were you raped?" And she said, "No, it was technically it's assault." He said, "Well, if you're not raped, we're not writing it up." She was assaulted once, and now she's been assaulted by her commanding officer, saying, "We're not going to bother with this." In the opening of the film, one of the women talks about with Gulf War illness, when the soldiers came back from the first Gulf War, many of them were sick, and they go to the Veterans Administration, and they say there's nothing wrong. And it was only been the course of 10, 12, 15 years that bits of information would be released and they would discover, oh yes, well, there were exposures of chemical and biological weapons because we blew up the ammunition dumps of the Iraqis during the war. The government first denied this. And to this day, the truth of what happened to the women and the men and their exposures and their illnesses, it's still a mystery. And there still has not been full disclosure by the government.
If we back up, there was one incident in the film where the sexual assaulter was perhaps Iraqi. And so the government said, yeah, if you're willing to cut off his hands.
This was a story that was told by a colonel. She's now retired. And she was very irate during her whole interview about how the women were treated under her command. And she really stood up for them. And she had a case of a woman, a nurse who was assaulted on an elevator by a Saudi soldier. And I must say that the assaults and the rapes were both Saudi, other foreign troops, and the U.S. troops. And in this particular case, she went to the commanding officer of the Saudi soldier and said, "This has got to stop. We can't have this activity towards the women." The commanding officer was playing with her and said, "Well, you tell me what you would like to do. Would you like to be demoted or punished, or what we would like is to have his hands cut off, and we would like you to do it." And so she said, "If you want his hands cut off, you let me know, and I'll do it." And so she stood up to this Saudi general.
Do you have a sense of the scope of the problem of, one, the Gulf War syndrome, the other illnesses, the homelessness that you mentioned and was also highlighted in the film, and the rape?
The rape and sexual assault, it's widespread and affects men as well as women. I know there's been a lot of information out. I know a lot of veterans groups called SWAN, which is a group called Service Women's Action Network, and I know that they lobby in Washington to try to get laws. But basically, the person who is your immediate superior can say what they want to you. They can, in case of a woman or a man, they can do what they want, and there's very little recourse that the person under them has, because then they become an outcast if they try to report their supervisor of doing this. There's a documentary just coming out now. It's going to be in Sundance called The Invisible War, and it's about military sexual trauma. In our film, since the women, and they're Gulf War veterans, and they all have Gulf War illness, we focused on their struggles with Gulf War illness. Gulf War illness, they call it the undiagnosed part. A lot of the people are diagnosed with fibromyalgia, MS, chronic fatigue, but I believe it's all part of the same exposures due to the Gulf War. And if they're lucky, they can get a diagnosis. One of the women in our film, Carol, she had to go to a private doctor to get a diagnosis. Once she had a diagnosis after several years, the Veterans Administration finally gave her some benefits. But it's very hard for them to get diagnosed. They're just told it's all in their head. I would say approximately 30% of the Gulf War veterans are disabled, but that's only the people that have gone to the VA. I would say up to close to half of them probably. And there are almost 700,000 that fought in the Gulf War, and 15% of that were women.
And let me just briefly plug Dennis Davis, who's also a musician, whose music people frequently hear on this program.
Yeah, thank you. I shot the film. We traveled all over the country. Many different cities, went to conventions to sit with these veterans who were very keen to tell us their story. It was about 10 years on when we first went to the convention of National Gulf War Resources Center, and we got set up a room, and women were so willing and wanting to tell their story. They lined up at the doors and they just poured their hearts out to us because they, I guess after 10 years gone, they had enough time to process what they've gone through and were able to speak about it because there was a lot of very heart-wrenching stories. So we felt very fortunate and honored to be there and to capture their stories.
It sounds like, though, you focused on women. Well, the Gulf War syndrome is something that afflicts both. Were there some that were unique to women?
Well, in the film, I go through how the Gulf War affected the women, their reproductive capacities. Many of them had hysterectomies, miscarriages, problems with severe menstrual cycles. I think what we try to show in the film is that when you have a sick veteran, the whole family is affected by the sickness of the veteran, the children, their husband. And the reason we call it Women at War is because since the women came back, they've had to battle the government to get benefits, to get treatment. Many of them were close to homelessness. One woman was told, well, we don't have anything for veterans with children because their homeless shelters set up for alcoholics and for different people. Maybe things have changed now, but when she came back in the 90s, they weren't prepared for women. So it was very hard for her to get treatment. One of the women in the film, Carol Williams, she was the only woman at the VA when she went in for treatment. She had to be in a geriatric ward. I think even in the current wars, it's about 15% of the soldiers are women. And I think they'd be having more women's outreach coordinators, but they still outsource to other clinics the women's reproductive help and things like that. You don't have really doctors on staff at the VA that are women's doctors.
There are a couple of things that stood out for me in the film. One was the suggestion that they were classified not as women, but as honorary men. And the other was that maybe some of the pills and the shots were used almost like experimentation.
The honorary men came because they were in Saudi Arabia. The women are covered. They're not allowed to drive. And so the women soldiers weren't allowed to drive. They had to be in a cab with another man. They couldn't go out into the cities. In fact, one woman wore a costume beard because her commander wanted her to drive so she could drive through Saudi Arabia. And so when you talk about voluntary, they were honorary men. It's because when they first got there, they couldn't roll up their sleeves. They had to be covered. And so when the king said, of Saudi Arabia, said they're now honorary men, then that means they could roll up their sleeves.
So they could show their
forearms.
And wasn't there a section in your film that a woman who was showing her forearms was actually asking to be raped?
Well, that was a section where the woman colonel, it was suggested to her that she cut off the hands of the Saudi rapist. And he said to her at the beginning of their conversation, you Americans like to show off your bodies. And by that, he meant rolling up their sleeves. So it's a very touchy subject in Saudi Arabia. I don't think this same thing faced the women in Iraq and of Afghanistan as in Saudi Arabia.
Now you guys are doing the first screening.
We have a preview screening on January 28th at 7 p.m. at Frank and Jane Dorrell's house. The address there is 3967 Shed Terrace in Culver City.
Well, Christy Davis, Dennis Davis, filmmakers of Women at War, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Maria.
When we come back, it's been 2 years since the Citizens United decision. What are the decision's effects? What are the deeper issues? What are the potential solutions? Next on the Scholar Circle. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to the Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. This week marks the second anniversary of the Supreme Court decision Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Commission, in which the court struck down in a 5-4 decision several campaign finance laws. What has the effect been so far? Outside spending on campaigns has risen 338% since 2006, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. Unions have spent some $17.3 million from their general treasuries on independent expenditures, while conservative nonprofit groups have spent some $121 million without disclosing the sources of that money. The center believes that the money comes from corporate sources. The issue of money corrupting political processes has received more public attention recently than it has in several decades. Comedians Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart are using parody to demonstrate the system's flaws. Citizens groups are working toward overturning the decision, while cities and states are passing resolutions, some which directly repudiate the Citizens United decision. Others reject the notion of corporate personhood, seen as one of the roots of the money problem. We're joined by three experts. Henry Brady is Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He is author of numerous publications, including Voice Inequality, Civic Voluntarism in American Politics, and Letting the People Decide. We also have with us Professor Scott Bowman. Scott Bowman is the Chair of Political Science at the California State University in Los Angeles. Among his publications is The Modern Corporation in American Political Thought, Law, Power, and Ideology. Professor Daniel Greenwood also joins us. He's a professor of law at Hofstra Law School and the author of numerous publications that explore the intersection of corporation, speech, and constitutional law. Thank you all so much for being with us. Dean Brady, the numbers are pretty outstanding in terms of campaign spending, increased spending. Can we tell what the impact is yet of Citizens United on the political system, on campaigns, and can we tell on lawmaking?
Well, we can certainly tell that super PACs have become more important in the political process, and super PACs are almost entirely a creature of Citizens United. We also know that, in fact, there was a lot more spending in 2010 than in 2006, the last comparable election, in terms of just being not a presidential election but a congressional election, and that had spending increased enormously between 2006 and 2010, maybe from $70 million to $300 million from outside groups that are sort of covered by the Citizens United decision. So there's no question but that there's been a lot more spending. Now, whether that has had an impact in the long run on law or even on campaigns is not clear. Certainly there seems to be a lot of sense that what's going on right now in the Republican nomination process is greatly affected by the super PACs, which seem to be saying things more or less coordinated, even though they're legally supposed to not coordinate such things, with the campaigns themselves.
They don't necessarily have to disclose sources of money when they're independent expenditures, so how would one know if they're coordinated?
Well, that's part of the problem, and that's part of what Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart are mocking right now on their TV show, where they're sitting there together and saying, well, they can't coordinate, and they're sort of wincing and, winking at one another and trying to figure out exactly what each other means about what should be done here. So it's really sort of making almost a mockery of the process.
Do we have a sense of how legislation is impacted through the campaign spending system? Has that been measured?
It's a really hard thing to get a handle on because the trouble is that you can find that a certain group that later has legislation that's favorable to it has spent a lot of money for a particular candidate, but you don't know whether they supported that candidate simply because from the get-go they thought that candidate would do what they thought that candidate would do, and you don't even know whether they had an impact on whether that candidate got elected or not. So it's a very hard thing to track. There's no question, though, it has the appearance of having an impact, and that's part of what the folks who put together McCain-Feingold thought was one of the issues that should, in fact, make that a good idea to try to control campaign spending.
Scott Bowman.
Yeah, it is difficult to actually determine the impact of spending. In fact, there's been a lot of studies tried to measure that over the years. But I agree with Dean Brady that part of the issue here is also, it's not just trying to determine the impact, but it's also the appearance. And that has a great deal to do with the electoral process as a whole and its perceived legitimacy. And going back to the early campaign, or actually the Federal Election Campaign Act itself and the early interpretations of that act, the court made it very clear that it wasn't just about the quid pro quo corruption, but it was the appearance of that corruption as well that justified restrictions on campaign spending. So that's a longstanding concern, and I don't think we should just be concerned with whether, in fact, we can nail it down that someone was actually influenced in their vote. I think the broader issue has to do with the entire process. And on that note, pursuant to your email to me earlier today, you asked if I'd read Lawrence Lessig's book. I went online and found that he has a lecture. So I listened to his lecture, and he, of course, proposes some seemingly radical reforms for the entire system to introduce a form of public spending and get rid of virtually all contributions that come from corporations and other entities. And a major part of that argument has to do with the fact that some 75% of Americans have lost faith in the system in terms of the way we fund campaigns. So I would say that's a major issue that has to be addressed as well.
I want to get into Lawrence Lessig's assessment in just a bit, but I think the third issue that the courts have brought up back when they were debating the Federal Election Campaign Act in the 70s was the issue of political equality and who can actually represent constituencies in contrast to those that are supported by very moneyed people or corporations. Professor Daniel Greenwood, let's bring you in.
I want to say first about the issue of influence and the difficulty of measuring influence. Part of the reason why it's very hard to measure influence is that in the Citizens United regime, and even in the regime that preceded it, it's possible to influence elections even without spending the money. Basically, all a person with a large pot of money, a corporation with a large pot of money, has to do is to threaten to intervene in order to affect or potentially affect legislators' votes. And I think this is part of why the possibility of money, as much as the reality of huge quantities of money, leads ordinary citizens to think that the system is not functioning. On the larger issue, the principle is quite simple. This is supposed to be a democracy, a government that is run by the citizens for the citizens. And corporations are not citizens. And even rich people who can, individual people who may be citizens, but can use their money to buy influence that is completely disproportionate to the influence they otherwise would have, threaten the very basis of the republic. So American law has been very clear since essentially the beginning of major business corporations, at the beginning of the 20th century, that corporations are not permitted to intervene in elections. We have allowed them to lobby to some degree, but there have often been restrictions on it. And the Supreme Court in Citizens United and has taken another large step in the direction it's been going since the 1970s, off and on, in essentially destroying the underpinnings of the electoral system. It's also a disaster from a corporate law perspective. It's quite shocking to find that corporate managers are entitled to spend money that is not their own, and the states that create the powers of the corporate managers apparently are limited by the First Amendment or by the Supreme Court's interpretation of the First Amendment from deciding how managers will use the authority that is entrusted to them.
One quick note, Professor Greenwood, about the intervention. When I worked for the California legislature, I actually witnessed this when legislators would attempt to take action in something that went against a very powerful group. There was definitely the threat of removal, and it clipped the wings of many legislators, I think.
Look, the point is this, right? Electoral politics, as expensive as it is quite cheap by comparison with the sort of consumer advertising that corporations ordinarily do. All a corporation has to do is to recognize that if advertising works, it should be able to affect not only the votes of the legislators, but the votes of the electorate. Advertising, they believe advertising works. They're willing to use it, and they don't have to divert very much of their ordinary advertising budget in order to create a lot more profits than they would by selling products, by instead changing laws. This threatens the system by which we keep markets working for us instead of making them simply opportunities for wealthy institutions to buy legal rights that the rest of us don't have that enable them to get even more wealthy so that they can buy even more power.
Scott Bowman, let's bring you back in because Professor Greenwood mentioned the historic precedents of corporations not being able to be engaged in the campaign process legally. How did we get here?
Well, we got here through a series of Supreme Court decisions. People were shocked by Citizens United, but actually several things preceded that. As long ago as 1978 in the Bilotti case, the court didn't formally extend First Amendment rights to the business corporation, but it sort of did it in a roundabout way in striking down a restriction on corporate expenditures in a referendum. But the court maintained after that expenditures in candidate elections were unconstitutional, and there's a federal statute that prohibits those, and that's basically the statute that was struck down in Citizens United. In the Austin case in 1990, the court upheld a similar limitation to the federal statute in Michigan. And at that point, the court put forth a novel theory. It's actually a theory it had sort of worked on in the previous case concerning the effects of corporate speech. They had to keep it in line in terms of precedent with the earlier argument in Bilotti that the reason you can limit contributions or expenditures for that matter is that it's somehow related to either a quid pro quo corruption or the appearance thereof. So what the court did is they extended that rationale, and they argued that the expenditure of large sums of money amassed through the corporate form constituted a type of corruption that distorted the marketplace of ideas. That became the new standard, and that was debated heavily at the time. And interestingly, Chief Justice Rehnquist was on the side of the majority. It was when Rehnquist left the court, Roberts came in, that everything began to change. So that was really the turning point. And then we see in some case law, in Wisconsin Right to Life case, a movement towards loosening restrictions that had been upheld under McCain-Feingold legislation, and then that just sort of paved the way for this decision. It was a 5-4 decision in Austin. Interestingly, Rehnquist was a critical vote. When he's replaced by Roberts, the court, many members of the court, were prepared to do this for years. Scalia, Thomas had argued that it should have been overturned, Kennedy as well. So it doesn't surprise court watchers that it actually happened, but it seemingly it came as a shock to the American public. Now, the other thing I would like to mention, the corporation had rights under the 14th Amendment going back to 1886. At least it was recognized as a person for purposes of property rights at that point. So it's had certain rights given to it since then. The idea, though, of giving it rights of speech is extraordinary, and you have to maintain that the corporation is a person in some sense beyond the legal fiction. The legal fiction argument is there, give them standing in court so they can sue and be sued with regard to property rights. So this is a very different matter. Frankly, I still can't quite figure out the court's reasoning. I've read these cases, I've written about it, but there's some kind of strange intellectual process that goes on when they argue that a corporation is similar to a person who has rights in the marketplace of ideas.
So the effect of this system, according to Lawrence Lessig, since you brought him up, he calls it the economy of influence, and that it discriminates rather than on one side or the other, but really against all sides to favor itself. So he's saying essentially that those who are most connected continue to keep themselves in power. The rich get richer not from innovation, but from manipulating the process. If we can bring Dean Brady back in, you've looked at issues of equality, perhaps not in the same framework that we're talking about, but how do you see this all coming across in terms of political equality?
Well, it's certainly a blow to political equality. Just to give you one quick statistic here, the Sunlight Foundation found out that in the 2010 elections, 27,000 donors, that's not the top 1%, that's the top 1% of the top 1% in the nation, gave about a quarter of all the money from individuals that went to candidates, PACs, political parties, and independent expenditure groups in 2010. So that means that a very small group of people are giving the bulk of the money. And presumably those folks get a chance to interact with the candidates, and I've been to some of these events where candidates meet with prospective donors, and there's nice conversations, and it's wonderful to get to meet the candidates, but I certainly know that the person who's giving $5 or $10 or nothing certainly never gets a chance to have these kinds of interactions. And so it's those kinds of things that makes you worry. Do the folks who are running as candidates not know the ordinary American? Do they have the kind of problem that we've seen Mitt Romney have in trying to describe his income situation, where you get the sense that he just doesn't quite understand what most Americans have to deal with, and perhaps that's because he hasn't had much interaction with the folks making $10,000 a year or $20,000 a year or $30,000 a year, because those people don't give the money that really fuels politics right now.
So it affects the electability, who is represented, who is representing. The other thing that doesn't get mentioned all the time that I think is important is that the dialing for dollars phenomenon really eats up a lot of legislators' time, leaving very little time for actual analysis of policy.
Yeah, and that's right. And they're not dialing again the person on the street. They're dialing people who have lots of money, who in those phone calls then say, you know, I'm really worried about X issue or Y issue. And we know that people who have lots of money have different concerns than people who have less money. It's as simple as you can imagine that people with lots of money are more worried about high tax rates, for example. People with less money are more worried about government services, good schools for their kids, and things like that. So that you have different kinds of issues that different groups care about, and those groups have quite different access to the political process because of the enormous role that money plays in politics.
Professor Greenwood, let's bring you back in.
Let me address that specific issue, because the dean was talking about contributions by human beings. And, of course, rich people have different interests than the middle class. But corporations have a different interest altogether. And it's really quite important to think about the difference between corporate contributions, which is the great innovation of Citizens United, as opposed to the older problem of the Supreme Court's equation of money with speech. It goes back now already a generation. The specific problem with corporations is that corporate donations are made by corporate managers who are bound by law to act in the interests of the corporation. Now, the law doesn't usually say what the interests of the corporation are, and so there's a certain amount of leeway here. But managers are directed to think about not the interests of the country and not their own interests, but the interests of the company. And the interests of the company will almost always be contrary to the interests of the economy as a whole and the interests of the country as a whole. In this sense, we need a dynamic economy in which new companies can innovate and can find new niches and create new products that create new jobs and new products, right? But incumbent companies, the existing companies, are almost always going to be threatened by innovation. And so what we're doing with Citizens United is we're creating an economic system that will use its power, and its power is huge, to change the law to create more economic power for the companies that already have economic power. You don't need to worry about an innovative product if you can simply get the legislature to pass a law saying it's illegal.
Scott Bowman.
We've seen that happen, actually, in recent years.
Or even this week with SOPA.
With merger movement itself, especially, the wave of mergers and media conglomerates are a prime example. And what really happened there was Congress was sort of captured, I guess you'd say, by corporate lobbyists, but also by contributions. I think, you know, corporations contribute both sides, so you can't say it was just a one-sided issue. But in addition to that, the Federal Communications Commission was staffed with people who were amenable to these changes or to this interpretation of antitrust law. And it just a remarkable shift in policy occurred beginning in the Reagan era and going on through, it was actually the late Carter presidency, and going right up to the present. And it was both administrations, Republicans and Democrats, who facilitated this. I think that's really solid evidence for what Professor Greenwood is arguing.
Perhaps this would be the perfect time to talk about this movement that seems to be gaining some ground. A lot of grassroots organizations, Common Cause, Public Citizen, Move to Amend, there are several of them working, it seems, in tandems. Cities are making resolutions in opposition to Citizens United. There's been an introduction of a constitutional amendment in Congress to try to overturn this. Perhaps this is something we've seen a little bit before. Dean Brady, can movements like this succeed? And if so, what does it usually take?
Well, it's possible this movement could succeed in the sense of getting past what it's proposing to pass. But the trouble is it's not clear what exactly you have to do to overturn Citizens United. The Supreme Court decision basically said that the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and said that applies to everybody, including corporations. So some people have said, well, that just means, let's say, that corporations aren't people. But it's not clear that you can define that in a way any kind of movement to say corporations aren't people that would in fact pass legal muster and that would in fact ultimately solve the problem. And so maybe the better way to go is to start talking about changing corporate governance. I think the bigger issue here is the fact that right now you have corporations which only have to think about their welfare in terms of the profit they're making, but maybe you have to have corporate governance changed in some ways so that in fact they also think about, okay, what's the general welfare and exactly how are they using their money to try to affect the general welfare. Now that's a big task to try to change that, and maybe that's impossible as well. The trouble here is that almost every direction you go, it looks like it's going to be really hard to change around Citizens United, given the current complexion of the court and given the degree to which they predicated it on the First Amendment that says there'll be no law abridging freedom of speech or the press.
I just wanted to note that there's also a movement by shareholders to prohibit the corporations from spending if it is in opposition to what they want, or to at least disclose how they're spending money from the corporation.
It seems to me that might be a better way to go, to try to get corporations to at least disclose how they're spending that kind of money. And in many ways, by the way, the thing I worry most about is corporations in a state, let's say, like Montana, which are very powerful, where the Anaconda Corporation for many, many years was enormously powerful, and corporations like that doing what one wag once said that the Standard Oil did to the legislature of the state of Pennsylvania, which was Standard Oil did everything but refine it. And it seems to me that the problem is corporations in states like that could have enormous impacts upon elections, because there that might be tremendously in their benefit to try to affect who gets in office so they can get special privileges, mining privileges or laws that are favorable to them and things like that. And that's the kind of place where real problems might arise. And so it's very interesting to see that the Montana Supreme Court recently said that there's a law that's been passed there in 1912 that said corporations can't give money to elections, and they said they wanted to uphold that law, and in effect they're challenging Citizens United through their affirmation that the Montana law should continue to limit corporate contributions.
Scott Bowman, I want to bring you back in to give us the historic matters that you've looked at. Some of the things you wrote about in your book include the intertwining of ideology and law and power. Can you link all of this together in terms of movements and how they've resulted here and how they compare perhaps to what we're dealing with?
The first thing that comes to mind is where we were 100 years ago in many respects. The center focused during the Progressive Era. The Progressive Era is generally 1895 to 1915 or so, depending on how one deals with the First World War. But during that period, progressives came together, people of different political parties, not just the Progressive Party, and the center of attention, really what they were focusing on, was corporate power. That's what the issue of the day was. And when I'm reading the press today and reading blogs and seeing this opposition to Citizens United, and it's broadened into a general critique, really, of corporate power in American politics, but also corporate power in general, I'm reminded of the progressive movement 100 years ago. I'm not saying that we have a new progressive movement, but the issues are very similar. And, of course, now we have global capitalism, not just capitalism in the United States, that people are addressing. That's one thing that strikes me. The other thing is that the ideological justification, for lack of a better term, of corporate power has become very sophisticated in the last 100 years. And so people, particularly justices on the Supreme Court, are able to defend corporations as if they were people, as if they were just speakers in the marketplace of ideas, and argue that their ideas are just as important as everyone else's. So there's something else that's gone on in this last 100 years, and that is that we don't have that same kind of shock that the Progressive Era people did about the rise of the large corporation and its influence on politics. It's something we've lived with for quite a while, but seeing this sentiment reborn, in a sense, is very significant. So I don't know if we're going to have a broad-based movement of this sort, but there are signs of it. The Occupy Wall Street is also a sign, in my view, of this kind of renewed sentiment. But what we're going to deal with now is very different. It's not an incipient corporate power. It's a well-established and institutionalized corporate power. And remedies are going to have to be very different.
I think it's very important, too, to realize that the founders dealt with a society that looked a lot different than society today. where there were not these large corporate entities with tremendous amounts of power, and therefore, to some extent, just going back to the Constitution and saying, well, that's what the founders said, let's interpret it that way, really misses what happened, as Scott says, during the 19th century with the rise of tremendously powerful corporations, and therefore makes us unequal to the task of trying to deal with the concentrated power that we now see in America.
I would say from a legal perspective, I'm not quite sure I agree with that. If there is, in fact, a political movement that wants to restrain corporate power, there's no constitutional problem. The Constitution doesn't mention corporations anywhere. And there's not even a problem that would require convincing the Supreme Court to change its interpretation. Essentially, any state that chose to define this not as a problem of speech, but as a problem of who is entitled to spend corporate money, could, if it had the political will, solve the problem within the particular state simply by saying that corporations, of course, as the Supreme Court has said, are free to spend their money, but that doesn't mean that the corporate CEO or the corporate board is free to spend money that is not its own in pursuit of its own views. The money belongs to the corporation, and the states get to decide how corporations make their decisions. And all a state would have to do to completely solve the entire problem would be to pass a law saying if a corporation wants to spend money to influence an election, it has to first take a poll of its employees and its customers to determine how they would like their money spent. And there's no possibility that any American corporation would agree to do that. They would simply opt out of the system.
And that is somewhat like what is going on with the shareholders movement.
It is to this extent that the shareholders are making an additional contention, which is that the money is theirs. That's simply not correct. They didn't provide the money. They're not entitled to the money if it's not spent on electioneering. And I don't understand any democratic rationale why we should allow shareholders, who basically are other corporations, to determine how our electioneering is done. It seems to me that that needs to go to the people, not to institutional shareholders. And the people in the cases of corporations are the employees and the customers.
I think that's a perfect place to end.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you very much.
Henry Brady is Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He is author of numerous publications, including Voice and Equality, Civic Voluntarism in American Politics, and Letting the People Decide. Scott Bowman is the Chair of Political Science at the California State University in Los Angeles. Among his publications is The Modern Corporation in American Political Thought, Law, Power, and Ideology. Professor Daniel Greenwood, he's a professor of law at Hofstra Law School and the author of numerous publications that explore the intersection of corporations, speech, and constitutional law. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and special thanks to Ankina Aghasyan, who produces the show with me each week. Also, special thanks to Ismail Karim, our assistant producer. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of this show, you can always go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives. You can keep up with us on thescholarscircle.org or armudian.com. See you next week.